This recording was made in Great Britain by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners. Recorded and edited by Dr. John and Dr. Valerie Graves. Copyright reserved. The treatment of hypertension. The speaker is Dr. Michael Hamilton.
In considering the treatment of hypertension, it is essential to remember two points. Firstly, that if treatment with a potent drug is considered necessary, it will probably be needed for the rest of the patient's life. And secondly, that the more time and care that the doctor is prepared to devote to the patient, and the more intelligent and cooperative the patient, the better will be the control of blood pressure. During the 12 years since hexmethonium first became available for the treatment of hypertension, considerable experience has accumulated concerning the indications for drug treatment. With the recent introduction of adrenergic blocking drugs and thiazide diuretics, both of which can control blood pressure with fewer side effects than are caused by ganglion blocking agents, these indications have broadened. But it is still only the minority of patients with a raised blood pressure who require treatment with these powerful drugs. When the diastolic blood pressure reaches very high levels, around or above 120 millimeters of mercury, particularly if such levels are reached over a short period of time in a young person, then the high pressure causes changes in the arterioles, producing a necrotic arteriolar lesion with a characteristic histological appearance. This lesion, in affecting the kidney, causes impairment of renal function, and unless the blood pressure is quickly controlled, leads to death from renal failure. Hypertension, which has entered this phase, is known as malignant hypertension. And I stress which has entered this phase, for this is a complication of hypertension from any cause, except, I believe, from that caused by coarctation of the aorta, in which the malignant phase has never been reported. The development of malignant hypertension demands urgent treatment by blood pressure reduction, for without treatment, over 90% of these patients will die from the disease within 2 years of the diagnosis having been established. It's therefore imperative to establish the diagnosis early in the course of this disease in order to start treatment as soon as possible. If a patient with hypertension presents with albumin and red cells and casts in the urine, even with impairment of renal function as shown by a raised blood urea, one cannot, on this evidence, diagnose the advent of the malignant phase of hypertension. For the changes in the urine may merely indicate the presence of some renal lesion which is also causing the hypertension. In diagnosing the malignant phase, therefore, one must look for some sign outside the renal tract, and this is found by retinal examination showing the presence of papal edema, which by convention is the sole physical sign permitting a diagnosis of malignant hypertension to be made. This first retinal photograph shows the typical appearances of the fundus of a patient with malignant hypertension. Demonstrates very well the papal edema so that it's impossible to see the optic disc at all. The optic cup is lost, the whole disc is pink and the edges are indistinct so that the optic disc blends with the surrounding retina. And surrounding this are large numbers of hemorrhages, soft white exudates, and some microaneurysms. The presence of these exudates and hemorrhages, particularly their sudden appearance in a person who is under observation, implies that the hypertension is deteriorating, entering what Leishman has called the accelerated phase. By observing the changes, such changes in the fundus, it's often possible to anticipate the advent of the malignant phase of hypertension and start treatment before papal edema has developed. From the therapeutic aspect, I consider that such a sudden retinal deterioration, that is the appearance of these soft exudates in a patient who previously had normal fundi, provides an indication for blood pressure reduction which is no less urgent than that provided by a patient with a fully established papilledema. The next retinal photograph is that taken from the same patient as the first after 9 months treatment with ganglion blocking agents. You'll notice that the papilledema has completely subsided and the exudates and hemorrhages have disappeared. Heart failure provides the main single cause of death among untreated hypertensives and, to my mind, provides an absolute indication for blood pressure reduction. Similarly, a patient with a high blood pressure who is becoming increasingly short of breath on exertion, or who on clinical, cardiographic or radiological examination shows signs of increasing heart size whilst maintained under observation, requires blood pressure reduction in order to prevent the development of heart failure. The use of potent drugs for the relief of headache is rarely necessary. In the majority of patients with hypertension, complaining only of headache with no other complications of the disorder, the headaches can usually be relieved by far simpler measures, reassurance, sedation, and weight reduction. Only if the headaches have failed to respond to these simple treatments and are proving incapacitating to the patient so that he or she can no longer follow their normal life is it justifiable to introduce treatment with these powerful drugs. The treatment of an entirely symptomless, uncomplicated hypertension is very rarely justified. I think it should only be employed in two types of patient. Firstly, in a young man, and by that I mean one under the age of 45 years of age, with a sustained high diastolic pressure, one which is maintained at over 120 millimeters of mercury. For it's established that such patients tolerate these levels of blood pressure very badly, and treatment is therefore justifiable in an attempt to prevent further deterioration or the complications of heart failure or malignant hypertension developing. And I think it's also justifiable to treat a symptomless hypertension in a pregnant woman in an attempt which, in my experience, is usually unsuccessful, procure a live child from the pregnancy. However, a young person with a symptomless, uncomplicated hypertension must be adequately investigated in order to exclude a unilateral renal lesion, aortic coarctation, or a pheochromocytoma, since surgery can allow radical cure in these conditions. The treatment of strokes occurring in hypertensives is still subject to a good deal of controversy. I believe that if a patient has had a stroke which leaves no residual physical or mental impairment, in addition to hypertension which justifies treatment, the presence of a stroke provides an added indication for blood pressure reduction. It's obvious, therefore, that the treatment of hypertension is largely confined to the treatment of its complications. Malignant or premalignant phase, cardiac failure or increasing cardiac enlargement, progressive symptoms or a stroke, and only very, very rarely is it justifiable to treat an uncomplicated, symptomless hypertension by any means other than reassurance, sedation, weight reduction. Having decided that treatment is indicated, one must now decide which of the many available forms of treatment is required for the individual patient. Raw Wolfia compounds, of which the active alkaloid is reserpine, although still widely prescribed, should never be used in treatment. It is capable of reducing blood pressure, probably by depleting the noradrenaline which is stored in the arterial wall, and so altering the vascular responses. But reserpine is a dangerous drug, causing side effects, some of which are merely troublesome, consisting of lethargy, a sense of nasal stuffiness, nightmares, lactation, and tremor. But two of the complications of reserpine therapy are highly dangerous. It causes considerable salt, and therefore fluid retention, and so may precipitate heart failure. And secondly, it induces mental depression, which is so insidious in its onset and progression that it frequently escapes detection until the tragedy of certification or suicide supervene. This last slide is a photograph of some rocks overlooking a beach in Dunedin. During a year which I spent there, two hypertensive patients committed suicide from this rock. And this photograph serves to remind me of one of the tragic complications of administration of Serpasil, which was the drug prescribed for these patients, which induced the depression, which propelled them from this rock. Ganglion blocking agents were for many years the only drugs which were capable of maintaining a sustained blood pressure reduction. All these drugs act by blocking the transmission of impulses across the ganglia of the autonomic nervous system. By virtue of their effect on the sympathetic system, they are used in the treatment of hypertension. When a normal individual stands upright, the increased hydrostatic pressure encourages pooling of blood in the vessels of the lower part of the body. But this is normally prevented by vasoconstriction. However, if the sympathetic supply to these vessels is not intact, no vasoconstriction occurs and blood pools in the dilated vessels of the lower limbs with a resulting fall in blood pressure. Thus, ganglion blocking agents produce a postural hypotension, and it is the object of treatment to reduce the blood pressure with the patient standing to whatever level is considered necessary. Unfortunately, these drugs also block the transmission of impulses across the parasympathetic ganglia, and this action is responsible for the side effects of drug treatment and consists of blurring of vision, dryness of the mouth, intense constipation which can progress to a paralytic ileus, difficulty in emptying the bladder, and impotence. The earlier drugs, hexamethonium and pentolinium or ansilisin, have now been largely discarded. As they had such poor absorption from the alimentary canal that they had to be administered parenterally. However, I still use parenteral ansilisin in order to achieve rapid control of hypertension when this is indicated, as in starting treatment in a patient with malignant hypertension or some of the other more acute complications of hypertension, pulmonary edema, or hypertensive encephalopathy. For all other occasions on which ganglion blocking agents are employed, mecamylamine or invasine or pempidine are now used. The latter is probably preferable as it is a shorter action and so is potentially less dangerous. Treatment should be started by observing the response of the standing blood pressure to a test dose of 1.25 milligrams, and then the dose increase gradually until adequate control of the blood pressure is obtained. All these drugs induce tolerance, so in the early stages of treatment, the dose of drug needed to maintain control over the blood pressure has to be slowly increased. In view of the side effects caused by ganglion blocking agents, and the need to control these with other drugs, for example the regular use of aperients to overcome constipation and pilocarpine to maintain a flow of saliva, all of our patients receiving ganglion blocking agents also receive an instruction sheet describing these complications of treatment and their management, and one of which is available for your perusal. The ganglion blocking agents have now been largely superseded by the sympathetic and adrenergic blocking drugs, of which guanethidine or ismolin is at present the sole effective member. As this drug produces sympathetic block, it causes a postural hypotension, and therefore blood pressure levels must still be recorded with the patient standing. As it does not block the parasympathetic system, it does not cause any of the side effects which proved so troublesome to patients receiving ganglion blocking agents. The only really troublesome side effect which it causes is diarrhea, and this can often be controlled by combining its administration with a small dose of invasine or pempidine. If so, this should be given at midday, as the blood pressure of patients receiving ismolin tends to rise during the afternoon. A single oral daily dose of ismolin is usually effective, and treatment should be started with 10 milligrams, increasing the dose by 10 milligrams two or three times weekly until satisfactory control of the blood pressure is obtained. Daily increases in the dose of these drugs will prove dangerous, as they tend to accumulate in the body, and profound hypotension may result if the dose is increased at too short intervals. The most recent introduction, methyl-DOPA, or Aldomet, prevents the synthesis of noradrenaline in the body, and thus leads to a tissue amine depletion. It is certainly an effective hypotensive agent, which does not cause significant postural hypotension, and is remarkably free of side effects. The initial dose of 250 milligrams four times a day is usually to be increased fairly rapidly, and most patients can be maintained on a dose of 500 or 750 milligrams four times daily. It does cause considerable fluid retention, and so, like proserpine, this drug is capable of precipitating heart failure. Its ability to control the most severe forms of hypertension, that is the malignant phase, is not yet adequately established, but certainly its ability to control the less severe forms of hypertension is already well established. Oral diuretics given in conjunction with either ganglion blocking or sympathetic blocking agents will potentiate their effect, and so permit a much smaller dose to be given with a consequent reduction in the side effects. I always use hydroflumethiazide, purely from habit, giving 50 milligrams two or three times a day in conjunction with all of the above drugs which I have mentioned. Given in larger doses of 100 milligrams twice a day, this diuretic is capable of achieving a substantial blood pressure reduction if given alone. In a group of 23 patients with an average blood pressure of 220 systolic and 130 diastolic, treated with 200 milligrams of hydroflumethiazide daily for at least 6 months, there occurred an average fall of 34% in the systolic and 27% in the diastolic blood pressure. When given in such doses, potassium salts must also be given to counteract the considerable potassium diuresis which this drug produces. For the immediate reduction of blood pressure, therefore, as demanded by a patient in pulmonary edema, by one in the malignant phase of hypertension, or a patient with hypertensive encephalopathy, parenteral ansilisin or hexmethonium is used initially, followed by maintenance treatment with ganglion-blocking agents or ismolin combined with an oral diuretic. For the less urgent reduction of blood pressure, as is needed by patients with retinal or cardiac deterioration, or with progressive symptoms, then pempidine or ismolin combined with an oral diuretic is indicated. For even less severe hypertension, particularly one causing increasing dyspnea or early heart failure, large doses of an oral diuretic combined with potassium supplements may prove adequate. But for the majority of patients with hypertension, no dramatic therapy is required, and all that is needed is weight reduction, sedation, and reassurance, that is, sensible management on the part of their doctor.
We should like to thank Smith, Kleiner and French Laboratories Limited for their generosity in paying for the cost of this recording. This recording was produced by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners.